who was by far the most important human present, helped human folly to her feet and spoke to her in a low, worried tone. That was ridiculous, of course. Human folly could stand and could speak, and so the odd girl was obviously well enough. Human folly looked rather frantic for a moment, until Little Mouse placed several small lumen crystals into the other girl's hands, at which point the etherealist's apprentice cupped them as if they were more precious than kittens. Grim Shiptrees was visiting his fallen and wounded warriors. Raoul approved of that. Even now, Norn was making the rounds of the wounded and fallen Nine-Claws warriors. The clan chief finished the task and prowled over to Raoul, his bloodied battle spurs clicking on the ground.
"Raoul?"
"Norn?"
"You slew as many as I did,"
Norn noted.
"Did I?"
Raoul asked airily.
"I was not keeping track."
Norn's tail lashed in amusement.
"The threat to my clan is gone. You were instrumental in making that happen."
"You are welcome,"
Raoul said. Norn stared silently for a moment, then he said,
"You spared the life of my kit when you had more than sufficient reason to kill him."
"I did."
"Why?"
"Out of respect,"
Raoul replied.
He lifted his right rear leg and peered at the bloodied blade on it.
"His battle spurs are excellent."
"Hardly used,"
Norn growled.
"Keep them." "Neen will not like that,"
Raoul noted.
"Neen will earn his spurs again. Perhaps this time something will sink in."
"I wish you luck with that,"
Raoul said.
"If you will excuse me, the spurs chafe."
Norn flicked an ear in farewell.
"Convey to your father my respects. His envoy is welcome in Nine-Claws territory."
"I will,"
Raoul replied. Norn rose without further remark and departed. Raoul turned back to watching Grim Shiptrees, and noted that the man was in the midst of detailing a few of his healthy warriors to help the human healer take the wounded to something more like safety. If he could smell the distant smoke in the air like Raoul could, he would be moving more quickly. But that was the way of humans. Like their minds, their senses were not particularly sharp. And if that wasn't bad enough, they spent an inordinate amount of time ignoring them or dulling them even further with their drink and their alleged music and their soap. So, no matter that they were standing in the only habel in all of Spire Albion filled with flammable buildings, and that the entire place might turn into a gigantic oven and cook them all, there were human matters to fuss with before moving out to take action. Years of living near humans had taught Raoul that there was no point in trying to hurry them, and had made him even more patient than he was puissant. They would be ready when they were ready. Meanwhile, he prowled over to Little Mouse, made himself comfortable, and started working on the laces of his new battle spurs. Knots were uncivilized creations. His thumb paw was really not well suited to undoing the length of leather cord that kept the cuffs securely on his legs, which was why a pair of squires was generally required to secure the cuffs in the first place.
"Raoul," Little Mouse asked, in cat, "would you please allow me to assist you?"
"Yes,"
Raoul said promptly, and lay down to relax while Little Mouse saw to the knots with her indecently long and precise fingers. Each creature had something it excelled at, he supposed. Humans could manage knots easily, and cats could do everything else. Little Mouse undid the knots and carefully slid the wide leather cuffs off of his legs. Raoul did nothing as undignified as sigh with relief once the tight, restricting things were gone, but a lesser cat than he might have done so. He felt quite filthy.
The foolish silkweavers had not drenched him in their vital fluids as they had some of the slower warriors of Norn's clan, but his fur was certainly speckled with the stuff, and it smelled. Raoul yawned and regained his feet before butting his head against Little Mouse's knee. Little Mouse knelt down to rub the spot behind his ears, which he allowed might also be a particular expertise of human-style fingers.
"You were so brave just now, Raoul," Little Mouse said. Her voice was very soft and warm. "You saved us."
It would have been unseemly to wriggle with pleasure at her tone, so Raoul restrained himself to rising and arching his back under her hand, so that it went all the way down his body and possibly wiped off some of the filth.
"I know," he said.
"How did you convince the Nine Claws to help?" Little Mouse asked.
"I saved their clan chief's kit."
"From what?"
"From me," Raoul said.
He stretched and flicked his rear legs one at a time until he felt that the fur was somewhat less disarranged.
"I would knock down a spire for you, Little Mouse."
Little Mouse made a squeaking sound and scooped him up in her clumsy human arms and gave him a smothering hug. Raoul leaned his cheek against hers and purred. After all, he could hardly be called unseemly if a human, even so exceptional a human as Little Mouse, got carried away in a fit of affection. And besides, her sleeves were cleaning his fur. The moment lasted until the tall, younger warrior beside Grim Ship Trees called, "Everyone else form up on me! Let's go!" And at last, only a nap or two after the last fight had ended, they finally began to move. The smell of smoke grew stronger and stronger as the humans huffed and puffed down the cramped streets of Habel Landing. Raoul loped along beside them, amused. Of the entire group, only his Little Mouse was moving steadily, clomping along in the same boots she wore while running with the guard. Evidently all that senseless fleeing about had done its work to prepare her for this evening. She was moving very well compared to everyone else in the little group. Not as well as a cat, of course, that was simply not possible, but better than the other humans, even the half-soul. Raoul looked at human Benedict curiously. He had always seemed markedly less clumsy than other humans to Raoul, but that had all but vanished. His legs were moving unevenly, and he was gasping for air just like the rest of them. He must have been weary. Though weary or not, he had wits enough about him to lift his nose to the air and inhale, finally noticing the smoke scent that had been obvious to Raoul since before they had begun their run. Raoul heard something and focused on the sound.
"Little Mouse," he called. "Gauntlet fire ahead."
Little Mouse dutifully relayed the message, or tried to. The first man she told to pass it up the line to the captain was wheezing too hard to make himself understood by his fellow humans. Little Mouse shook her head, picked up her pace, and ran ahead to Grim Ship Trees to inform him. The humans spread out as they approached the temple and slowed their pace to a more cautious stalk. If one could even truly consider it a stalk. To Raoul, they sounded like the clump and clutter of a steam engine, except for Little Mouse, who, to her credit, sounded only as loud as a particularly clumsy lame kitten. Raoul had no such concerns. He would be seen only if he wished to be seen. He darted ahead. There was a great deal of smoke billowing out of the Temple of the Way, probably due to all the fire he could see glowing within it. A number of humans had apparently tried to form a line, where they would have presumably passed buckets of water along to one another, so that whichever human was most foolish could throw it at the fire. Metal buckets lay scattered everywhere, along with several corpses of the humans who had attempted to use them. As Raoul watched, a human leaned out of the shelter of the wall around the temple, appearing in the gateway, and loosed a gauntlet blast, burning a blazing trail of tiny cinders through the pall of smoke. He quickly ducked back, just as several other blasts hammered against the stone of the wall near him, sending chips of rock flying. The humans of Landing, it would seem, were not taking the killing of their own lightly. Raoul broke into a sprint, covering the open ground between the rest of the Habel and the Temple's territory at his best speed. From there, finding a convenient stone projecting slightly from the wall made it possible for Raoul to jump to the top and take stock of the situation. There were half a dozen humans inside the Temple's wall, all of them armed, all of them positioned to pop up from concealment and fire gauntlets at anyone who approached. Raoul took note of their positions and leapt lightly from the wall, rushing back to Little Mouse. He told her in rapid tones what he had seen, and Little Mouse relayed his words to Grim Shiptrees as the group approached the temple. Shiptrees nodded once, his expression hard.
"Why burn a temple of the way?"
Human Creedy asked. "I don't understand."
"Why burn a library?"
Little Mouse answered.
"There must have been something of value in it, something that would prompt the Aurorans to make sure that it all burned by leaving men behind to ambush the Bucket Brigade."
"If they aren't letting anyone in," Human Benedict said, "they aren't letting anyone out either."
"They aren't going to get away with it," Shiptrees said in a very quiet voice. "Long guns, I believe, Mr. Creedy. We've an extra with Mr. Stern down. Can you use it?"
"Tolerably well, sir," Human Creedy responded.
"Then you and the others will provide covering fire while I lead the charge."
Shiptrees glanced around.
"Sir Benedict, I would appreciate your aid in this entry."
"Of course, Captain Grimm,"
Human Benedict said.
"Mr. Kettle, you're with me,"
Shiptrees said. Then he turned to eye Little Mouse.
"Miss Targwyn, if you are willing, you will accompany Sir Benedict."
Little Mouse swallowed but nodded firmly.
"I will."
The captain turned to the rest of his warriors and said,
"The rest in two columns, following us. Get through the gate and blast any hostile targets you see. If the man in front of you falls, keep moving and take the shooter before his gauntlet can cycle." "Mr. Raoul," Shiptrees said, turning to the cat, "I do not expect you to engage in undue risk in a firefight, but your senses are far better than ours. I would take it as a courtesy if you would accompany us to see and hear anything we might not realize is happening. Will you do this?"
Raoul regarded Shiptrees amused. He would enter the temple, or not enter it, precisely when and where and as he pleased, or else what would be the point in being a cat? But Little Mouse was going, and that meant that he would go as well, to guide and protect her. Obviously. But even if she hadn't been going, Shiptrees had consistently showed courtesy and respect above and beyond that of most humans. The very act of it was a statement of respect in itself. Raoul may well have helped him in any case, so he gave Shiptrees a slow nod.
"Thank you," Shiptrees said. "The rest of you, column up by twos. Keep it tight, people. Give the long guns as much room to shoot in as possible."
Then, without further ado, he drew his sword and began loping toward the temple, leaving four men armed with the odd-looking human weapons behind him. Raoul raced to catch up with Little Mouse, who was running in a strange, jerky motion, as though her body longed to break into a mad sprint toward the danger, or away from it. Her best speed would have left the weary aeronauts behind, though, so she kept the pace slow and careful. Then it was all the sound of boots striking the floor in rhythm, and the scent of sweating human, and the kindling glow of gauntlets being primed. Then the man in the gateway popped his head around the corner again. The long guns behind them howled, sending streaks of heat and light sizzling by within an arm's length of the column. They slammed home into the stone of the gateway sheltering the enemy soldier. But these were no mere gauntlet blasts.
Long rifles were an order of magnitude more powerful than a gauntlet, and instead of blowing chips of stone from the wall, they blew stones out of the wall and sent them flying in every direction. Three more blasts struck only half a second later, and rock flew out in a shower as a square yard of stone wall, and the enemy crouched behind it, vanished in a torrent of radiant energy and a rumbling scream of breaking stone. The long guns began to yowl repeatedly, blowing holes in the wall near the positions Raoul had described to Shiptrees. Ah, that was what covering fire meant, then. It meant that his humans would shoot at the other humans and make them cower, while the true threat came racing toward the front gate, along with all of his humans and his half-soul. As they drew near the gate, Raoul took it upon himself to make things easier on the poor creatures he'd been rescuing all day, under the theory that an ounce of prevention would be worth a pound of cure. He darted ahead of Shiptrees, exploded through the gate, moving as low and fast as a cat could, and let out the defiant howl of his battle cry as he did. Human voices shouted in surprise, and a wild gauntlet blast blew apart a brick planter several yards behind him, while another splashed harmlessly onto the spire-stone floor wide of him. Grim Shiptrees and Half-Soul Benedict came through the gate at almost the same instant, running, gauntlets primed. Both men unleashed blasts at their opponents without slowing down, and Shiptrees dropped one of the enemy with a shot to the sternum that knocked the man down and cracked his ribcage with an audible snapping of bones. Little Mouse and Human Kettle came in on their heels, also firing. Little Mouse's bolt came nowhere near threatening another being with harm, but before more blasts could be loosed, the enemy warriors were lifting their hands over their heads and dropping to their knees. That would have made it significantly easier to dispatch them all, but for some reason, Shiptrees and the other humans stopped fighting. Raoul puzzled over that for a moment as the rest of Shiptrees' warriors came rushing through the gates. Human Kettle took charge, took away the enemy warriors' gauntlets and blades and bound their arms, which seemed to Raoul like an excess of preparation for cutting their throats. Over the next several breaths, it occurred to Raoul that the humans were not going to cut anyone's throat. What was the point in all the fighting with gauntlets if they were only going to stop fighting the moment the outnumbered fools decided the fight was over? Raoul flicked his tail in exasperation. Humans. This close to the fire, the heat was palpable, and the heavy smell of smoke was almost nauseating. The fire was a constant growling rumble from the interior of the temple. Now that he had time to look about, Raoul spotted several very still forms in crimson-stained saffron robes lying here and there in the gardens, like particularly morbid beds of flowers. "Maker of paths," Human Benedict breathed, sweeping his gaze over the corpses. His eyes shone with unfallen tears. "O great Maker, show me the path, for I am lost and cannot find my way." Raoul prowled over to Little Mouse and leapt up into her arms, the better to be able to see through the crowd of humans.
"Skip," Human Kettle said, nodding to Shiptrees. "Four prisoners, none seriously wounded. They say the rest of the Aurorans are already gone. They volunteered to stay behind and won't say anything about their mission or where their officers are going."
Shiptrees grunted and shook his head, staring at the burning temple.
"Burning a library. Damned waste."
He turned to one of his warriors and said, "Go inform Mr. Creedy of what happened, and ask him to direct the firefighting brigade here at once."
"Aye, Skip," said the man, and hurried off. "These guys could save us a world of hurt if they start talking." "You want me to persuade them, Skip?"
Human Kettle asked. He slammed one knob-knuckled fist into his opposite palm.
"No time," Shiptrees said. "The Aurorans are already on the move. Why burn a library?
A diversion, Human Kettle suggested, to draw us away from their real target. It's going to get plenty of attention, Shiptrees admitted. But, he narrowed his eyes, what if this wasn't a diversion? They only sent 30 men for the bloody Lancaster Battery. They brought their whole force here. Why?
This entire infiltration and attack, Human Benedict asked, his voice tight and bitter with pain, just to burn books?
Books are knowledge, and knowledge is power, Shiptrees said.
More power than a crystal battery?
Human Kettle asked dubiously.
Someone seems to think so, Shiptrees said, his voice thoughtful.
Raoul heard a faint sound and snapped his head around to the proper direction in which to direct his attention. A moment later he heard the sound again, a voice, weak, choking on smoke. Raoul turned to Little Mouse and said,
If it matters, someone is still alive in there. I can hear them.
Little Mouse blinked at him for a moment in that charmingly witless way she had, and then blurted out a translation of his words to Human Benedict.
Human Benedict's eyes snapped to Raoul.
Where?
Raoul leaned his head toward the temple and said,
Am I an oracle? No, I am not. Inside.
Human Benedict stepped up next to Raoul and tilted his head to one side with his eyes closed. They snapped open again a moment later.
He's right. We have to do something.
The smoke could easily kill you,
Shiptrees said. Never mind the fire.
Human Benedict clenched his jaw, and then he turned and sprinted into the burning temple.
Benedict!
Little Mouse cried. She dropped Raoul like a sack of stale tubers and went running after him. As she did, a full quarter of the roof at the rear of the temple gave way with a rumble of falling stone and a thundercloud of rising sparks dancing madly in the whirlwind. Raoul's heart went absolutely berserk, beating so hard that it threatened to stop up his throat.
The building was on fire. What was Little Mouse thinking? Such things were deadly.
Had she no consideration at all? Who was going to give Raoul his favorite ear rubs if Little Mouse were burned to char and ash? The very thought made him want to crouch against the ground and curl into a little ball. It was a truly shocking discourtesy. He should let her be burned up if she was going to treat him in so cavalier a fashion. Except that the very thought of Little Mouse being all burned up made Raoul's fur begin to tangle with itself. Without any further hesitation, the cat growled and rushed forward into the burning building.
Chapter 57 Spire Albion, Habble Landing, Lumber District. Major Ispira stood wiping the blade of his sword on a white cloth as his men prepared to burn the wealth of this overstuffed den of rats to ashes. Gauntlet fire howled around him from nearly every direction as his men held the perimeter against the Albion citizens and odd guardsmen who had realized that battle was upon them. There were thousands of Albions in this rat maze of a Habble, and the fight at the temple, brief as it had been intense. His force had been brought down to a total of fewer than 350 men. There would be even fewer after they fought their way out of the lumber district, but the more quickly they moved, the fewer he would lose. Though his men were outnumbered incalculably by the locals, his marines were organized and moving together, not reacting in a confused herd. The most difficult and dangerous part of the mission, the wait, was over. Now it was all straightforward knife work, and no one knew fighting like his marines. He stood in the middle of a street of shops, trying to ignore the presence of the Cavendish creature and her pet monster. Sark loomed near her, always near her, his presence a silent and constant threat. The warrior-born man was wounded and dripping blood, but moved as if he had not noticed that his forearms and belly looked like so much shredded and bloody meat beneath his tattered clothing. The woman clutched a book, the one book they had removed from the great library, open to one of its early pages, her finger tracing the lines, her eyes intent as she read, as if she stood in a reading room and not a combat area with the cries of the wounded and dying all around her.
"Sergeant," he called, "how long?" "Setting the fuses now, sir,"
Siriaco replied. Espira nodded and continued wiping the blade of his sword, though he knew on a rational level that he'd cleaned the blood from it long since. It gave him something to do besides wait for the proper time to give the next order. And besides, he liked having a weapon in hand when Cavendish and Sark were so near. The corpse of the young man who had blundered into Espira and surprised him, probably a carpenter's apprentice, lay inside one of the shops nearby. The boy had been no older than 14 years, and probably younger. Sheer chance that he'd started up from a sleeping pallet on the floor behind a counter just as Espira had walked past in the gloom. After that, it had all been reflexes and a gurgling scream that Espira knew he would not be able to wipe away. Now the boy's body was covered in sawdust and awaiting the fire that would take the guts out of the busiest economy in Spire Albion. The charges were being set in small kegs, piled with sawdust from the leavings of the mills and carpenters and woodcarvers who worked this district of Habble Landing. They weren't standard demolition powder kegs, but incendiaries, a hellish mixture of fire oil, fire powder, and sticky jelly that would explode and then cling to anything it touched, burning fiercely. They were most often used to set fire to airships in close engagements, and Despira had seen their vicious efficiency at destruction with his own eyes.
"What do you think, Sergeant?"
he asked. "Did the engineers get it right?"
"Sun's about to come up,"
Siriaco replied, nodding.
"Warm up the east side of the tower, which will draw the air and send the fire spreading toward it, just like a chimney, but sideways.
Once it starts hitting those supports, that second level of theirs will collapse right down into this one. The Albions'll be too busy to pay us any attention at all." A marine corporal came running up and spoke briefly to Siriaco.
"Major,"
the sergeant reported, "charges set. Fuses ready at 60 seconds. Espira tried not to think about the men, women, and children he was about to condemn to death by fire and asphyxiation. This area was the heart of Landing's economy, a viable target of war, and if the Albions had ignored the wisdom of the great builders with regard to flammable construction within a Habble, that could hardly be blamed upon Spire Aurora. Espira looked around at the wooden buildings, the wooden walkways, the wooden supports and beams, representing more wealth than any dozen Habbles of his home spire. Their greed and vanity were their weakness, and would be their undoing. He was simply lighting a match. "Order the men to form up and begin moving out by squads," he told the sergeant. "Advance party to fire freely and clear the way. Standard firing rotation." Siriaco had known what orders would come next. He nodded and started bawling them out even as Espira gave them. Then he moved out to oversee the withdrawal. Explosions began, small and scattered, as the marines commenced throwing ceramic grenades packed with gunpowder and sulphurous ash to cover their escape with vicious shrapnel and clouds of thick, choking smoke.
"Madame Cavendish," Espira said, keeping his tone calm and civil. "Excuse me, please."
Her eyes snapped from the page up to his, coldly furious, and one of her eyes twitched in a steady rhythm. She stood stiffly, clearly in pain, and a tear and a modest stain of blood on the bodice of her dress suggested a wound sustained when she and Sark had stayed behind to deal with the group of Albions who had attacked them. Espira swallowed and kept his expression neutral and pleasant. "Please pardon my interruption," he said, "but we are ready to withdraw to the ship, and this area will soon be on fire. For your own safety, I must ask you to accompany us at this time." K
Cavendish closed her eyes for a brief moment, and when she opened them again, her own expression had been schooled into something blandly pleasant.
"Of course, Colonel."
"I beg your pardon, ma'am," Espira said, "but I am a major." She smiled, her teeth showing as she carefully closed the cover of the book and worked the latch that locked it shut.
"Not after today, Renaldo Espira."
She purred.
"Not after today. Sark?"
Cavendish turned on a heel and began marching calmly down the street as though she were running an everyday errand. Sark moved with her, maintaining a precise distance behind her and to one side, his crooked gaze scanning steadily. Espira let out a small breath of relief to see them go. He looked forward to the day when he did not have to deal with those creatures. Even more than he looked forward to the golden insignia that would come with his new rank when he returned home to Spire Aurora. Assuming he returned home. There was plenty of time yet to be killed. He put his sword away, mentally cringing at the act, though he knew rationally that the blade was perfectly clean and could be sheathed without issue. Then he pocketed the handkerchief, opened his box of matches, and waited for the last of his troops to retreat toward escape. Suriako, as agreed, was the last of the men to fall back, and he covered Espira with an upraised gauntlet as Espira knelt to the fuses. Then the Auroran commander struck a match. Chapter 58. Spire Albion. Havel Landing Shipyards. AMS Predator. Gwendolyn grimaced down at her borrowed clothing. The grease on them was simply not going to come out, which hardly seemed polite to their owner, whoever he was. Perhaps she should simply dub the outfit her engine-room clothing and reimburse the poor unfortunate. After all, making a mess of one's clothes was to be expected when adjusting the alignment of a Haslet cage. It was a frustrating task at the best of times, made more so by Mr. Journeyman's insistence upon using some hare-brained process he had developed himself rather than the doctrine that was clearly published and illustrated in the handbook to any Haslet cage by any manufacturer worth the name. Granted, the man did seem to get results. It was vexing. Gwen slid out from beneath the cage's assembly and said, "There, try it." Journeyman grunted and adjusted the controls, constricting the cage down to a smooth egg shape, rather than the usual sphere. The power core engaged the cage, a lacework of lightning suddenly branching out to it from the core crystal. A deep-throated, sweetly musical hum filled the room, a chord that made the deck beneath Gwen's feet vibrate and rattle. The bustle of the bleary-eyed contractors and engineers in the room drew to a halt as they awaited the result of the test. Journeyman stayed rock-still and eyed the readings on several meters on the control panel.
"Well, now," he said. "Well, well, that doesn't look completely terrible."
Gwen padded over and studied the readings. "They're perfect. All well within tolerance."
"Tolerance?" Journeyman said with a scowl. "Good enough for shop trogs and tramp merchant engine room slugs. Not good enough for my preddy."
Gwen scoffed and began to answer him when she paused. "What was that sound?" She reached over and throttled down the engine, spinning the wheel that dilated the cage out to its widest setting again. Journeyman let out a huffing sound of protest and actually slapped her hand away from the controls. But Gwen lifted a finger to her mouth and snapped,
"Quiet! Shh! Everyone!"
There was a startled moment of silence, and in that space, everyone in the compartment could clearly hear what Gwen had heard. The howl of discharging gauntlets. Gwen traded a look with Journeyman, and then pelted up the steps from the engine room to Predator's deck. She hurried to the railing and stared out over the shipyard. The morning mist was thick, but glowing with the warm golden light of sunrise, and she could see out over the wooden shipyards to the entrance to Havel Landing. Two of the Havel's guardsmen lay on the wooden deck, horribly still,
Even as Gwen watched, a third crouched beside the entrance, triggering his gauntlet wildly, was struck by a bolt of radiant energy that snapped his head back like a blow from a red-hot mallet and flung him to the deck atop the bodies of his fellow guardsmen. A second later, several men in grey uniforms came through the door, blades in one hand, gauntlets glowing in the other. They immediately opened fire on several stevedores who were unloading a freighter at the nearest slip, sending the men scattering for cover.
"Bloody hell!" Journeyman said. "Those are Auroran Marines!"
More men poured out of the opening at a quick jog, dozens of them. As heads began to peer out from ships and storehouses, gauntlets howled, wounding and killing a few, sending most scattering for cover.
"And they're coming this way," Gwendolyn noted.
She heard cries and shouts, and glanced to the next ship over, a motley-looking vessel whose lettering named her the Mist Shark. Men rushed about the deck in orderly haste.
"What are they doing?"
Journeyman grunted.
"Getting ready to cast off."
Gwendolyn frowned as the crew of the Mist Shark began casting down two additional boarding planks and sucked in a sudden breath.
"They're transport for the Aurorans."
"Aye," Journeyman said. "We better get our heads down, lass. They'll be within range shortly."
Gwendolyn made an impatient clicking noise with her tongue and climbed up onto the rail to get a slightly better view.
"Those men back by the gates, what are they doing?"
Journeyman peered.
"They're setting charges," he grunted.
The men suddenly sprinted away from a number of small casks. There was a loud whumping roar, and suddenly the casks were replaced with brilliant balls of light that rained drops of fire out in a wide swath. Fire began to chew brightly at the wooden decks wherever the burning rain touched.
"Merciful God in heaven,"
Gwendolyn breathed.
"How long will the deck hold?"
"Not long," Kettle said grimly. "And then..."
Gwendolyn's stomach plummeted into some unthinkable abyss as she imagined the deck, Predator, the engineering crew, and herself all plunging down the side of the spire to be crushed on the surface far below.
"We've got to get the lift crystal back online,"
Gwen said.
"We've got to do more than that,"
Journeyman said, and pointed toward Mist Shark. Gwen was no expert in the actual operation of airships, beyond the technical details of their engines, but even she could clearly see what was happening, and it made her fallen guts turn to ice. The vessel preparing to transport Spire Albion's enemies was running out her guns.
"We don't get the shroud up," Journeyman said. "We're finished."
And without a further word, the two flung themselves toward the engine room. Chapter 59. Spire Albion, Habel Landing, Temple of the Way. It was not the fire, or the smoke, or the prospect of immolation or asphyxiation that most disturbed Bridget as she plunged into the burning building behind Benedict. Instead, she found herself wishing that she had tied her hair back so that it wasn't flying behind her like a banner, threatening to collect any random spark that might float by, thus bursting into flame and leaving her bald, right in front of Benedict. She felt that a very foolish concern, though she could not deny its reality. The other dangers far outweighed the threat to her vanity, after all. Or perhaps, she thought, such a tiny concern was the only one she was allowing herself to feel. Only weeks before, she had been frightened to leave her father's vattery. If she dared to allow her mind to grasp the truth of what she was doing, she felt sure she would begin to weep and then run screaming. So she embraced her little worry about her hair. It kept her from going mad in the face of much more horrible things. The entrance to the temple was no more dangerous than a thick pall of smoke could make it, but the smoke permitted them to see only 10 or 15 feet ahead of them. And as they advanced, the pall began to glow with a sullen, flickering light as the fire spread from the library into the other portions of the building. The lack of visibility was disorienting, and she lost track of where they were within moments. What if, she thought, they simply became lost in the smoke?
What if they found themselves rushing from hall to hall, struggling to find a way out, while the whole time the air grew thinner and hotter until... "Benedict!" she cried, her voice frail and rough with smoke. "Where are we?"
"Stay on the path," he croaked back.
"Ah, of course." Bridget looked down. She was following Benedict closely and had only now noticed that the warrior-born moved with his feet firmly tracing the little meandering indentation in the stone flooring, letting it guide them forward. She covered her mouth and nose with her sleeve and pressed on. The air grew hotter, the light brighter, until they plunged from smoke into a blazing inferno. They stumbled to a sudden stop, and the blazing hot wind, like something from an enormous oven, began to lift and billow Bridget's hair. The great library was being consumed by flame. Vast sheets of it roared everywhere. The heat was so intense that miniature cyclones of flame swirled and circled around the room, being born and dying in the space of a few seconds. At the doorway to the library, one of the heavy shelves had fallen. A man in saffron robes lay pinned beneath it, and a mound of books that was slowly taking fire. His fingertips were bloodied, as if he'd tried to claw his way out from beneath the imprisoning weight, and been unable to do so. His skin was reddening, blistering under the fury of the fire. The monk lifted his head. One of his eyes was gone, vanished into a vast, purpling bruise that swelled that side of his face to grotesque proportions, the result of a glancing hit or near miss from a gauntlet blast. He stared at them with his bleary eye. His expression was a contortion of agony. "Vincent!"
Benedict cried, his voice anguished. He leapt into the blazing heat, lifting his arms to try to shield his face as he did. His sleeves began smoking almost at once.
"Leave me,"
the monk gasped. He began to fumble weakly with his robes.
"Take it."
"No one's getting left anywhere," Benedict said. Then he knelt down, planted a foot, and reached out his hands. Bridget stared in fascinated horror. The shelf could not weigh less than a ton in metal alone, never mind the weight of the books still contained on its upward side. And in that room, the metal would be heated to searing temperatures. Benedict slipped his hands beneath the edge of the shelf next to Brother Vincent's trapped body. Then he clenched his jaw and gripped it. There was a sound like sizzling meat. Benedict let out a leonine roar that bore only a passing resemblance to a scream of pain. And then his lean body bowed into the effort of lifting the enormous shelf. For a second, then two, nothing happened. And then his legs quivered, and the enormous mass began to move, if only by inches. Bridget leapt forward into the oven. The heat was like a smothering blanket, painful, and getting noticeably hotter after only seconds of exposure. She grasped Brother Vincent's wrist and forearm and hauled his burned form from beneath the shelf.
"Got him!"
Bridget shouted, dragging Brother Vincent toward the hallway. Benedict dropped the shelf and it crashed to the floor, sending up showers of sparks. They burst back into the hallway together, and the sudden lack of furious heat made Bridget start to shiver as though she had walked into an icebox. It wasn't until she turned to let the wounded man down gently that she saw the horribly misshapen contour of Brother Vincent's back and shoulders. The man was shuddering in pain, arms twitching and shaking, but not his legs. Below the shoulders, he was completely eerily still. She looked up to find Benedict staring at Brother Vincent in horror.
"Oh, maker of paths,"
he breathed. He sagged down to his knees beside the monk, as if the sight had drained the strength of his legs entirely out of him.
"Oh, Vincent, no time, boy,"
Vincent said. He choked on a couple of short, hard coughs, and blood suddenly flecked his lips, which quirked into a small smile.
"Literally, for me."
"Damn it," Benedict said.
damn those Auroran sons of bitches. I'll murder every last one of them.
Brother Vincent's expression became annoyed, and he slapped irritably at Benedict's leg.
Benedict, there is no time for this kind of indulgence.
He fumbled at his robes again, and with a grimace managed to produce a book with a very plain brown cover.
Take it.
Benedict accepted the book, his expression bewildered.
What? Take it, Brother Vincent said.
Blood had begun to run from his mouth.
To the Spyrarch. It's the last copy. She burned the rest.
What is it? Benedict asked. Brother Vincent coughed again and grimaced in pain. The blood, trickling from his mouth, had turned his teeth bright red.
What they came for,
he said.
The index.
I'm getting you out of here, Benedict said. You can give it to him yourself. A smile touched the unmarred corner of Brother Vincent's mouth.
Oh, Ben. Death is just one more path. One you'll come to in time.
He lifted a hand weakly, and Benedict gripped it tight.
Don't let your pain choose your way for you,
Brother Vincent said quietly.
You're a better man than...
And then the monk died. Bridget saw it. In mid-word, the light and life in his eyes suddenly, simply, went out like a snuffed candle. What had been Brother Vincent was now an inanimate object.
Vincent?
Benedict asked quietly. Vincent! Then his voice broke with a ragged sob.
Vincent!
Bridget stepped up beside him and put her hand on his shoulder.
Benedict,
she said, quietly urgent,
we have to go.
He nodded. He put the monk's hand down gently onto his chest, his seared fingers moving stiffly, clumsily, and then he began to rise, and suddenly pitched forward over the corpse to land in a limp sprawl atop it.
Benedict!
Bridget cried. She grabbed him, rolled him over. His body was twitching in rhythmic shakes, and there was saliva and foam leaking from the corner of his mouth. His eyes were rolled back to the whites.
God in heaven, the silkweaver venom!
Bridget shook him, slapped him, shouted at him. But he never stirred or gave any response.
What was she to do?
With a roar, the doors of the great library burst into flame on their hinges. Bridget ground her teeth. She wasn't sure she could find her way back, but if she didn't take action, they would both die in moments, if not sooner. She rose, seized the warrior-born, and dragged him up. His limp weight was difficult to manage, but the heat and smoke were getting thicker, and she could think of no alternatives under the circumstances. She screamed and thrashed and strained and finally managed to get him over one shoulder. Then she started staggering toward the exit, then realized that she had forgotten the book Brother Vincent had given his life to protect. Dropping down to get it was quite difficult, but not nearly so hard as standing up again with Benedict's weight dragging at her shoulder. She headed for the exit, following the grooved path in the floor. She couldn't move very quickly. The burden was too heavy, but she dared not leave him to rush out for help. He might have choked on smoke by then. So Bridget grimly put one foot in front of the other and kept moving ahead. She never saw the Auroran marine before the man emerged from a cross corridor and collided with her. Bridget fell with a cry, trying to keep Benedict from landing on his head as she crashed to the floor. The impact hurt. The Auroran landed near her, and something metallic clanged on the floor. Bridget stared at him for a second in wonder. The man had been wounded. There was blood on his tunic and more on one leg, and a swelling lump the size of a child's fist on one side of his head. His eyes were glassy and dilated. Had he been knocked unconscious out of sight of his companions? Surely the Aurorans had been in a hurry to leave as well. He stared at her blearily. Bridget's eyes dropped to the source of the clinking sound.
The man's copper-clad blade lay on the floor between them. She looked up again, met the Auroran's eyes, and felt a sudden surge of terror, of confusion, of certainty that this had just become a deadly encounter, and saw the same feelings mirrored in his eyes as they stared back.
"Merciful builders," Bridget realized. "I've managed to get myself into a duel after all."
Except that there would be no rules, no marshal, no supportive friends, no crowd of observers. If Bridget lost this duel, no one would ever know it. The Auroran let out a slurred cry and threw himself toward the sword. Bridget's foot got there first, kicking the weapon from his grip. The man lunged at her, hands grasping. She twisted in the defensive maneuver Benedict had taught her, and caught one of his arms instead. The man jerked his arm away and seemed startled when he could not free it from Bridget's fingers. Bridget whirled with the man, using his own strength to begin the motion, and swung him into the nearest wall. The impact made his knees wobble, and he fell to the ground, with Bridget keeping the hold on his arm. He threw a punch with his other arm, and though Bridget managed to roll in the same direction to lessen the force of the impact, the blow made her see stars. There was no time for astronomy in ground fighting, she thought, and her sudden hysterical laugh turned into a scream of fear. The Auroran got some of his weight on top of her, his hands scrambling for a hold on her throat. If that happened, she knew, she was likely as good as dead. A proper chokehold could leave her unconscious in seconds, and in the frantic terror of combat, the amount of force required to crush a human windpipe was a surprisingly minor effort. At the same time, she realized that the Marine was faster than she was, and stronger, and had more experience at this kind of business. The only reason she was still alive and fighting at all was that he was clearly injured and disoriented, barely able to move upright. She got her forearms lined up on his chest, intersecting one of his arms, and holding his weight off of her as he tried to secure a grip. One hand got to her throat, but she hunched her neck muscles against its crushing pressure and kept it to one side where it could do less harm. The other she held off with both of her arms, straining, knowing that the longer she had to fight against not only his muscle but against the weight of his body, the faster she would tire. She struggled to throw him clear, arching her body, but he was too strong, simply too big for her to move. She fought for what seemed an eternity, though she knew less than half a minute went by, and felt her arms weakening, felt the fingers of his other hand brush against her throat. She took a terrible gamble. Instead of trying to push him again, she abruptly relaxed her arms and slammed her head forward into his as he came down. She heard a significant-sounding crunch. The Auroran reeled back, blood fountaining from his nose, and fell, banging his head against the floor as he did. Bridget gave him no time to recover. She rolled atop him, and began slamming her fists down at his skull in elemental brutality. The Auroran tried to hold up his hands in a feeble defense, but only for a few seconds. Bridget pounded his head into the ground, and once his hands were down, she seized his hair and began using that to bash his skull onto the floor, again and again. She barely realized that she was terrified and screaming at the top of her lungs. The smoke thickened, and she began choking on it, struggling to get her breath. She stumbled away from the now limp body of the Auroran, back to Benedict. She felt so tired. The fight had been only seconds long, but she felt as though she'd been running for 24 hours straight. Once more, Bridget managed to lift Benedict to her shoulder, if only barely. At least she'd had the presence of mind to pick up the book first this time. She could not stop coughing as she staggered forward onto the path, and realized with a dawning sense of horror that she was lost. This was an intersection of corridors. Paths wandered off down all four of them, and the fall and the subsequent fight had disoriented her completely. She could not tell which hallway led out.
She felt her head getting lighter, her balance beginning to waver. She did not have time to choose incorrectly. If she didn't get out of the smoke, and soon, she would fall, and could only hope that neither of them would awaken when the fire claimed them. She turned slowly, hoping to gain a clue, but the smoke now obscured anything beyond a few feet, and it all glowed with firelight. Her already teary eyes began overflowing, and she let out a scream of rage and fear and frustration.
"Little Mouse!" called Raoul's voice.
Bridget's heart surged with sudden energy and hope. "Raoul! I'm here!" The cat suddenly appeared from the smoke, his tail flicking in agitation.
"You are rude, and this smoke is in my nose, so that I could not track, which is also your fault. And we must leave!"
She managed not to choke on a sudden burst of terrified laughter, and tried to answer in cat, but her throat seized on the smoke, and she began to cough instead. She nodded and gestured for Raoul to take the lead. They had not gone 20 feet before the beams began to give way with ear-splitting screeches, and the masonry of the temple began to collapse around them. Chapter 60 Spire Albion, Havel Landing, Temple of the Way.
"I don't like it, Skip," Kettle said in a quiet tone, meant for Grimm's ears alone. "Girl running into the fire like that."
"She's not some helpless schoolgirl, Mr. Kettle," Grimm replied. "She's one of the Spire Arch's guard."
Kettle snorted. The grizzled aeronaut had come through all the scuffles of the last few days with nary a scratch, Grimm noted, which was better than he could say. Kettle had a knack for standing in the right place at the right time during a fight.
"And it's not our job to babysit one of the Spire Arch's guards, Skip?"
Kettle asked.
"That is correct," Grimm said. "And you don't like it either?"
"No, Mr. Kettle, I do not."
"Then we go in after them."
"Don't be foolish. I'm not ordering the men to rush into a burning building."
Kettle drummed thick fingers along the hilt of his sword.
"So it'll be just you and me then, Skip."
Grimm ground his teeth. He was concerned about Sir Benedict and Miss Targwyn, and his instincts were to go to their aid. But he didn't know the building, and if he went, some of his men would, in all foolish probability, follow him into the inferno. Enough of his crew had been hurt for one day. If he led his men blindly into that smoke, he might as well truss them all up himself and toss them into the building to die.
"No, Mr. Kettle," Grimm said. "We wait."
Kettle grunted.
"How long are we going to give them?"
"Not long," Grimm said in a frank tone. "If they aren't back out in the next few minutes, they aren't coming out."
Just then, several hollow, thumping, whooshing sounds shook the air, and Grimm whirled around to stare intently out the temple gates to the Havel proper.
"God in heaven!"
Kettle muttered.
"Skip! Was that—"
"Incendiary charges," Grimm said bleakly. "Maybe a quarter mile that way."
"In the Havel?"
Kettle blurted.
"God in heaven help us! All those wooden buildings!"
"Yes," Grimm said.
Even as he spoke, he heard an alarm bell beginning to toll frantically.
"No one's going to be able to think about anything but fighting the fire for a while. A rather convincing distraction that will allow the Aurorans to escape to the shipyard quite neatly, if they're quick about it."
Kettle snarled under his breath.
"Then they're already on their way."
"Don't worry, Mr. Kettle,"
Grimm said.
"We'll have our opportunity to make them answer for it."
"How?"
Kettle asked.
"Trust me,"
Grimm replied. He took a short, sharp breath and said,
"Unfortunately, this means that we need to leave immediately before the fire spreads and traps us in this corner of the Havel."
"But Skip,"
Kettle said.
"For all practical purposes, we are now at war with Spire Aurora. We each have our own duties, Mr. Kettle,"
Grimm said.
"The guardsmen will have to look after them."
He was interrupted by a roar from behind him, as the high portion of the temple, the enormous chamber of the great library, came crashing down upon itself,
taking various sections of the building with it. Dust and smoke billowed out in a vast cloud, and the fire, that which hadn't been smothered by the collapse at any rate, was suddenly exposed to more fresh air and blazed up wildly.
"God in heaven!"
one of the men gasped, and the cloud of smoke and dust